Welcome to a Prevent Connect audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 22nd at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
And in that vein, we are moving to our last panel for the day. And representing more than 100 years of, as Ted said earlier, the first generation of men being held accountable, we will be bringing to you the words of young men who are committed to doing this work. So when we talk about prevention and we talk about what's next, this is what next. So I'm going to ask our panelists to come forward. I want to recognize first Byron Hurt, acclaimed filmmaker. If you haven't seen Busta Rhymes, Beats and Rhymes, please go and please find it and see it. It's a wonderful, wonderful documentary, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you Byron Hurt. He's going to be joined by Juan Ramos from Safe Horizon, who many of you know, Juan. Quentin Walcott from Connect here in New York as well. Jess Nowlin, an advocate from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And someone very special and dear to my heart, Teddy Wright, my son.
Okay. What's up, y'all? Y'all doing okay? Y'all good?
Yeah.
All right, good. So we're in the home stretch right now. I want to introduce all of the panelists to come up to the stage. And as they come up to the stage, I want to give a final big shout out to A Call to Men and its leadership, both male and female. I want to give a big, big, huge shout out to Public Offender for their performance earlier today. We give them another... And Bishop Freeze, I don't know if Bishop Freeze is still here, but you know, there was a lot of energy in the room today. And hopefully at the end of this session, we'll all walk away feeling somewhat inspired and motivated. He's also, yeah. We'll feel inspired and motivated and you know, feeling like, you know, we have some energy as we go back into the work that we do in the world that we work in. And I feel like this was time well spent this afternoon. So, and also I want to give thanks to all of the panelists and to Jackson for your words, your comments, for your experience, for your leadership, for all of the things that you have done over the last, I won't say how many years, but over the last years in terms of providing the kind of leadership for young men like myself and the men who are on this panel. So we're gonna get right into the panel right now. I'm not going to do too much talking because I want to give you an opportunity to get to know these young men who are on this panel today. And they're here on this panel for a very good reason, because they're doing great work in the communities that they live in. They're doing great work around the country, wherever they are. And so now is our opportunity to get to know who they are and to kind of get underneath their experiences and to get inside of their minds as they do the work that they do. So I'm going to open it up to the panelists to kind of go down the line one by one individually. And I was just curious to know, before we start, who were some of the major women in your life who inspired you or who served as a major influence for you all as men who helped to shape your activism, especially when it comes to men's violence against women and anti-sexism?
My name is Zell Mill III. I'm from Austin, Texas. I work for an organization called Safe Place, and I wear a lot of hats. I do a lot of mentoring. I teach poetry. A couple of my young men happen to be in Public Offenders, who I worked with when I was there in high school. And my mother, first and foremost, and Lori Carlos, who was a theater artist from New York. She was the original woman for Colored Girls Who Committed Suicide. When the rainbow wasn't enough, she was a Lady in Blue, the original Lady in Blue. That's my mentor. I call her Mama C. And she's the one who really held my hand and walked me through a lot of this type of work.
You got to say your mother, man. You got it. If you don't say your mother, man, you're in big trouble, brother.
So my mom. good stuff. You know, has been a force for me. I remember the first time that I saw Ted and Tony, or that I saw Tony, was my mom brought home like a VHS video that we stuck into their VHS video player.
Right.
When I was like in high school, and she was always bringing things home for me to like look at, see, check out, as a way to support me coming up, you know, from jump, and engaging me and being a man who got to like say some stuff about men's violence against women. And I think the other big influence for me was Audre Lorde, like, who just laid it down and really kind of helped catalyze my thinking.
Well, that's a loaded question for me because it's a laundry list, but I'll try to be good at getting all the names. First and foremost, I want to thank my mom, who I don't usually talk about, but kept me safe from her batterer. And then indirectly, a lot of women who came into my life through my mentor, one of my best friends at the moment, who came into my life at a very special time, Ted Bunch. And indirectly to him, he connected me to women like Phyllis Frank, women like Bea Hansen, women who really inspired him and had him inspire me. I also want to give a shout out to some of the closest women who I've been working with lately, my staff at Safe Horizon. A lot of you have met them outside. They've been working the tables. They inspire me every day in doing this work because of the support they give me. One of my dearest friends and one of my favorite people to teach in a classroom with when we work with men, this conference planner, Dolores Hunter. Another woman who was very inspirational to me during my time working under Ted was Carol Morrison, who really shaped how I got the information and how I passed that information forward. She really gave me critical feedback and thinking around it. And I've also encountered other women like Connie Marquez from Substand Family Violence, who, through her support of me, continue to push me further in doing some of the work, and all the dynamic women that I ran into. And I also want to thank my father, and this is weird. I want to thank my father because when he decided not to be present, he allowed room for some dynamic women in my family to really step forward and pave the way for me to really understand what it is to be a man in the family and what that meant. And to my grandmother, who may God have her in heaven, who always told me, and some of you social workers may not understand this, but she always said, if you come here and you haven't treated a woman right, get ready for your butt whooping. So, but back in my day, that was something that meant a lot, and especially in the Latino community and the Latino family. So I thank her for that. She was a zero tolerance woman. So I wanted to thank her for that. So, thank you.
For me, it's fortunately enough, I had a little inside track to this question from Byron, so I made a little short list. But actually, as many of the same people that Juan mentioned in terms of this work, and the list grows, it's growing every single day. But initially, of course, my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and my great-aunt, those are the first, that was the core in terms of me understanding what it meant to be, you know, what the experience of, you know, black women. So that was like the first piece. And then in terms of doing this work and my development in this work has definitely been some of the pioneers here in New York City. The Alyssa Del Tufo, the Mary Havlins of the world, Sally McNichol, and later on, For me, the people I work with immediately now, and that list is constantly growing. Kala Ganesh, who's executive director of Connect Now, Pam Edstrom, Susan Urban, Elaine Wolf, Samaya Coleman, Carol Granum, Kerry Moles, and Connie. All of those people have been shaping my development in this work, and I have to definitely mention people on my staff, and my colleagues, Shireen Roig, Maria Santiago, and there's many, many more. But that's just the short list.
Hey, Mom, I'm sorry. Byron, if I may, I forgot to mention someone. And this is a quick little story about this. This woman had me in fear speaking to her for a long time because she just has this presence to her. And as I looked out in the audience and I looked at her, I always used to say to Ted and Tony, well, I'm afraid to approach her because she seems so serious with me. And that's Gwen Wright. And also somebody who really did something for me recently. I've been having struggles in my church to really speak to everyone in our community about violence against women and what that means in the church. And someone who came to me one time after she heard me speaking about this and gave me great support was Sally McNichols. I want to just give you a shout out because you've really been an inspiration to me and helped me challenge my pastors. And, well, we know the story from there, right? So thank you.
All right, big shout out to Sally McNichols. Right.
So part of the problem for me is that I didn't have a real good, positive woman role model in my life, and I'm really a poster child of dysfunction, and I was in a really bad way by the time I was about 17 years old, and there was an elder man from my family who he took me in, and he's the one who really inspired me and taught me how to be a man, and that's when I realized that I had it all wrong. And he passed away just not too long ago, and he, you know, he was very, very important to me. But since that time, I guess if I have to pick somebody, I'd have to say my partner and my 5-year-old daughter, because they're, you know, it was tough for me to stay on that track after he left. You know, I was really angry because he was still a pretty young man when he died, and every day, you know, it's like a struggle, just like with anything, to keep that going straight. And they're really my inspiration. And the only other person that I want to mention is my auntie Desiree Allen Cruz. She's the one who got me started in this involuntarily.
All right.
Yeah, so she was just like, hey, this is what you're going to do, and I'm counting on you to do good, you know. And it's really allowed me to release a lot of things, you know. And I hope that in the talks that I've made, that somehow by becoming transparent in front of all of the people that I've talked to at conferences, that somehow I've helped somebody, then that's good to me, and I want to thank her for doing that, because I sure as heck wouldn't have done it if she didn't tell me to do it.
All right, well, thank you very much, and thank you all for sharing, you know, your personal stories and the influences in your life. Most of you on the panel, I think all of you on the panel have done some, if not an extensive amount of work, working with boys and men around masculinity and physical and sexual violence. But there had to be a first time, right? So my question to you is, do you remember your first time addressing a room full of men or boys and men? And what did that feel like for you?
My first time was, I was sent on an intake to work with this kid. You know, he begins to tell me, he has a bracelet on his ankle. He's 18 years old, and he begins to tell me about his girlfriend whose stepfather is abusing her and her 2-year-old son, and how he can't really do anything because he has a bracelet on, so he can only go so far. And his stepdad was verbally and emotionally abusing him, and that was my very first intake, and I remember going back to my boss and was like, I'm done, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. I don't need to do this. Wow. I will go back to the art school that I was working at. And, you know, talk to 5- and 6-year-olds about their shirts, because It's not gonna take this home with me. And I just remember she just was like, take a minute, you know, take a minute, take a minute. And I drove home and just remember, like, you know, I was the one he shared that story with. And then I've held a lot of responsibility. I felt like I needed to be back that next day because I told him I was coming back. And so I had to go back and haven't stopped since then. It's about 4 years ago.
Wow. Wow. Great, man. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Teddy's trying to remember. My first experience was before A Call to Men was A Call to Men, before they actually used the term A Call to Men for the now organization. They used to go around doing these little workshops with men called Speaking to Men, A Call to Men. So Ted and Tony asked me to come up to Nyack, I think it was, right, Tony? And they're like, oh, we're doing this great work. And, you know, you heard Ted and myself do this before, Tony was telling me. And you know the material. So I'm thinking I'm there because they needed help with some boxes and stuff. So it's about 5 minutes before we start. And Tony goes, well, go ahead, then start. You know how he talks? Yeah, go ahead, then start. And I go, what you talking about? He goes, well, this is baptism under fire. And I remember after that, too, Ted had told me pretty well how to understand how to, you know, talk about working with batterers and working with men and what it means as a man to work with women. So I thought I gave a pretty good spiel, and then this woman stood up in the audience and said, well, I'm not going to clap for you like everybody else because you ain't saying nothing you shouldn't be saying. Mm. And then I went to Tony and like, see what you did, man? Like, this lady's angry at me. He goes, well, you know, she's only telling you the truth because you ain't saying nothing you shouldn't be saying. And that's when I got it. That the work that I'm doing is not about the, you know, I felt good as a man. I'm doing something good. And it's not about feeling good. It's actually about work that needs to be done and work that I'm glad that I'm doing. Because, as I said, some of the inspirations to me were the women that I most love in this world. And one of the biggest inspirations for me now is the little girl that I'm trying to raise, who I love so much. So that was it for me.
Let's see. It was about 12 years ago, actually. I was my first batters group. I wasn't even fully through my training around what it meant to be a facilitator. I was trained by Dr. John Aponte, who I definitely want to give credit to for all of this. He said halfway through the training, you're going to go and, you know, run this batters group. You're going to be a silent observer. And it actually didn't turn out that way. I was probably about 23 at the time. I was the youngest person in the room, getting ready to talk to about 25 men about their relationships and fatherhood and masculinity. And I was probably around 23, 24, and I looked about 15, 16. So it really didn't help. So the first thing was they called me son. And I was like, all right, I'll meet them where they are. They said, meet you. So I called them dad. No, I'm sorry. Seriously, so the first question was, how long have you been in a relationship? And I think about that time, I was probably 3 years into a relationship. How many kids do you have? None. And then the other question was, when did you stop battering? And I was like, wow, that's a deep question. So I think, me being looking young and inexperienced at this, I had to come back real creatively. And then I said, first of all, there's a fine line between me being a facilitator and me being in the circle with you. And then I had to kind of dazzle them with my brilliance. So I just kind of start dropping all these terms around power and control and male privilege, et cetera, et cetera. And after a while, I think I just got on their nerves and they said, you know what, this kid may not have a lot of experience, but his knowledge base is huge and his passion is amazing. And I speak with my hands. So they dug the fact that I spoke with my hands. So that was my first experience.
Yes.
(Clears throat)
My first experience was right after Desiree said, yeah, this is what we're going to do. So she didn't really say what it was we were going to do. And she just said, well, we're going to have you talk at this conference. And so I got up there, and there were a couple other people in front of me. And they all pretty much said everything that I thought I was going to say. And so back home in our language, we have, it's called Chakhops Tamna Sinwit, and that's just where you say whatever's on your mind. You just kind of open yourself up to everyone. And so that's what I did, and kind of told my story about, you know, all the things that happened in my life and how I came to be who I was and what I was working on. And when I had myself open like that, just for some reason, every time I do it, all the embarrassing stuff seems to come out. And so I was able to get some good laughs out of the people that were there. And it kind of helped me, you know, relax a little bit. But it was good for me because I, you know, some of that stuff I had never told anyone before. And I was just kind of just spewing out whatever because I had like 45 minutes to fill. And I could have did it in 15 if they would have let me to. But I remember afterwards, people came up and talked to me right afterwards, and they were like, hey, man, we want you to come talk at our conference, and we want you to come be a part of this and work with our boys and do this and do that. And I was happy to do it. I felt much better after I did it. So that was where I got started.
All right.
I remembered, I could go?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So I think part of the issue is that there are a lot of firsts for me. So I'm going to just tell a little story. When I used to do a lot of bullying prevention trainings, and I'll go, you know, they fly me in, drop me in for 2 days, and I'd work with like 40 or 50 young people and some teachers and try to like shift the way that their schools were functioning and, you know, less bullying, less violence, more like helping each other out. And I was at a middle school and in Texas, and you know, I've done this whole, you know, we do this whole thing where we like try, everyone gets to name like the kinds of like violence and bullying that goes on in their schools. And I'm about to like wrap up that section, and then for those of you who like facilitate groups and stuff, you know, there's that moment when you're like, you think you're done, but then somebody in the back is kind of like so I had that moment in this, you know, this young little white girl was like, well, there's the nervous game. And I was like, oh man. I saw all the young folks in the room were like, oh. And all the adults were like, huh? Yeah. So how many folks here know what the nervous game is? Just want to check. I got one. All right, cool. So when I was younger, we called it, do you trust me? Right? So I invited some folks to share, you know, what that game was about to the whole room, and we had this whole conversation. And she said, "Well, you know, it's like sometimes it's girls with boys, but usually it's boys to girls." And she's like tripping over her words, and now she's real like, "Oh." And she explained how in middle school the setup was that you could have these boys start touching your body, and they would move their hand, you know, up your leg or up your stomach until they got to a point where you said stop. And then they had to stop. And they went on. We went on to have a conversation in which we talked about, because I couldn't just let it go, right? So we went on to have a conversation about the ways in which these young girls felt like, well, if you say stop too early, there's a problem. You get called names, right? If you say stop too late, there's a problem. You get called names, right? And so they were getting boxed in. And then I had to have this whole other conversation with the dudes in the room asking, why do we play that game? Why do we think it's okay? And what would be the difference if when that dude came back from playing that game and said to his boys, oh man, I was just playing the nervous game, if his boys said, yo, that's messed up, man. That sounds like a violation to me. I don't like to have people touch on me, even people I like, right? So that was what turned it for me. I'm sitting in there, I'm doing all these bullying trainings, and just getting deep in the understanding that so much of the bullying that we see, that we call bullying, is like some really gendered, like sexist grooming stuff. And that was what flipped it to me.
Thank you very much. I know that for most of you, you've probably been in situations where it's been very difficult to reach some men in a room, right? How do you personally deal with the some of the denial and the deflection and some of the resistance that you see when you're in a room working with boys and men? And what strategies do you use to combat that? Or to address it?
I think it's best to do it head up, straight up, and right to the point. I mean, I think that kids have a BS detector like nobody's business. I work with kids in middle school and high schools. I have 7 schools that I go out to, and I do a 24-week program with them. And the young people I work with, they have either been in abusive relationships, come from abusive relationships, come from abusive homes, been in some type of violent situation. And so when we sit down and start talking about things, it's really, I think someone said yesterday how, you know, they can, you know, you can get and do some work around, you know, you shouldn't hit your girlfriend. You know, there's ways to talk to your girlfriend. But the minute somebody says something that is leading to homosexuality, the whole room shuts down, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just had an incident where one of my middle school kids came in, was like, I asked for this one kid. I was like, and they were like, well, he's not going to come anymore. And he was like, well, he's gay. So that was the whole thing. So we really had to, you know, and I want to, you know, there was no dancing around it. We just sat it down. I said, well, what does that mean? Like, let's define it. And I wrote everything that we said on the board. We're just going to write it out, and we're just going to talk about it. And then once we figured out, we defined it. It's like, okay, well, does anybody have a problem with anybody like that being in this room? Then we had to go around that whole thing of, like, why? And it was interesting. One of the things is because they were under the assumption that because the person was gay, that they were going to want them. And I was like, well, do you think that gay people might have preferences? Like, maybe you're not attracted to them. Maybe you're ugly to them. Maybe they think that you know what I'm saying? And so, like, I just hit everything straight up, head up, and honest with them, because I think that detector that they have, if they know that you're not honest with them, you lose that relationship, and I can't afford it. So I'm always honest and just straight up with them.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thanks for that, man. I find that the greatest resistance I catch is when folks start to feel their feelings. Dudes, many of us were not raised, socialized to really hang out with our feelings. So one of the things that I've started doing really recently, so part of my own personal practice is like, you know, sit around, feel my feelings. It's tiring. I sleep a lot more now than I used to. And to really encourage young folks, especially young men, to let them know that feeling your feelings is an act of resistance, right? So you have all these structures that are trying to hold you down, box you in as young people of color, as men, as young women, but, you know, particularly like young men of color, the folks who I most interface with, and like letting them know that just like feeling it, like that's some resistance and you can just hang out with that. And it might not, and it, you know, in the beginning it might not feel great, but eventually, like, when you stop getting worked by your feelings and start working your feelings, like, it's, you know, that, and then that's the place where we get to go. Because the first thing I see is, like, they want to just, like, check out. And so, you know, kind of invite them along and feel your feelings.
For me, it was learning how to use the word we. And the we means that as a man, I am you and you are me. And when you're in that room, you have to be that transparent, because if we come into rooms, for example, and try to work with men, and you kind of make yourself that good guy, and you never include yourself as being part of the problem, then it's very easy for you to lose a room full of men. So I think the word we is very powerful when you're working with men especially. I also happen to be very well trained, because I know very well how it is to be uncomfortable in a room with a man who's throwing all these things at you for you to examine. Because when I first came to work with Ted, I was 20 years old, and all I wanted was a job. And every day I came to work, he would stop me, bring me into his office, and tell me how he does the work, how I'm going to do the work, and what's accepted and not accepted. And something that I learned from the women that I work with is that when I'm in a room, especially if I'm alone with men doing the work, that I always need to envision the woman that they've impacted and how they've impacted her, and think she's in, and imagine her in that room, and if I start colluding with them, how dangerous that can be for her. I think it's very powerful for me.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because it depends on the situation, depends on the individual, if I'm working with youth, if I'm working with adults. But I have these, first thing I try to do is create a safe space, and not, you know, ground rules, but, you know, room agreements, and we work on that together, and then we basically, you don't have to literally sign on, but we sign on that this is what we need, just to have this conversation. And confidentiality is very key. But I have these four C's that I kind of, you know, run my groups by, do workshops by, do trainings by, and the first one is, and you know, anyone can use this too. The first C is courage, because this is domestic violence, this is gender violence. We're talking about some very, very serious issues and topics. So many of you may have anxieties around this work, anxieties around working with boys or males, et cetera. So definitely checking and tapping into that. And a lot of times, particularly young people are scared to have conversations with young people on the bus, on the corner, in your hallway, et cetera. So it's really, you know, looking at that, tapping into your own emotions and feelings around that, and, you know, proceeding forward. Because these kids are probably scared of you as you are of them. So that first piece is that courage. And the second one is that creativity. You know, because you're dealing with young people, you have to speak, Malcolm X said, speaking a language they can understand. That's the premise of all the work that I do. So we could be very clinical, we could be serious, we could be historical, we could be whatever, but you gotta kind of explain to them what you want in a language that they can understand. And that language may be using Beyond Beats and Rhymes by Byron Hurt. It may be doing role plays. It may be, you know, just kind of sitting back and letting them talk, you know, listening. So that's key, being really creative around that. And again, it's not recreating the wheel like we talked about in the former panel. It's like using what's available in a different way, or, you know, adapting and upgrading what we have to be more relevant to who you're dealing with, and it's changes. And the most important one is the consistency. You can't come in an hour and a half one time and disappear. The work we're doing right now, I'm doing some work right yesterday, that's why I wasn't here at the conference all day, Walton Educational Campus. We work with the young men in the high schools there, and you can't come in one day. And I hope that, you know, the curriculum and the outline is great, but I think the most effective piece is that myself and my colleague Marlon, we're there every Thursday. They see us, they rely on us. If we're not there, they hold us accountable. So I think the consistency piece is definitely important. And then the last C, and it's probably the most important one, and it's a floating C, is communication, right? Talking, having conversations. And a part of communication I want to stress and emphasize is the listening part. Because we could talk all day, but if we're not hearing what they need to say and addressing their needs, we're ineffective.
Back home at Umatilla, we have some serious problems. And so there are a lot of programs and things that we don't have in place yet. So the way I'm going to answer this question is about how I've interacted with the people in my community and some of the strategies that I've used to try to help. And the way that I've helped is just by trying to live my life to be something that the people who are younger than me have something to look up to. And it's been a great responsibility. I started that when I was 17 years old. And so I've spent half my life trying to live my life this way. And without even knowing it, I earned the respect of a lot of people. And back home, the way we do things is always by age. The older men are at the front, and the younger men are at the end. But I'm always being pushed towards the front, even by men who are 50, 40, 50 years old, I have to stand in front of them and be an example in the ceremonies. They're counting on me, they're looking up to me, and they're asking me questions. And I've really had a hard time keeping their respect, because a lot of them are, have problems that haven't been addressed because our system there doesn't meet their needs. That's not available. And so they'll try to trap me into messing up and ruining my credibility. And so, just like my man on the end said, those guys have a good BS detector too, I'll tell you what. So I just gotta shoot them straight, you know, and just concentrate on what I'm doing and hoping that somehow that I can impact them in a positive way. And this year, 2 years ago, we got our first school on our reservation. Thank you. So this year I'm going to try to help out with those young men as much as I can, and I appreciate everything that everybody said here. You know, I'm going to take that into consideration when I start working with these young people, and I'll be looking to all of you guys to help as I start working with people who are younger than me, and instead of just trying to be an example, really push to make some change.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all very much. At this time, I'm going to invite the audience to ask some questions. We only have about 15 minutes or so left. And so I want to give you all an opportunity to ask whatever questions that you have to any one of these individual men. And I ask that you make your questions brief, if possible, and limit your questions to questions and not comments. And that's how it's going to work.
I got you. Okay. So I'm really happy to hear from this panel. And something that's really, more annoying or bothering me more these days is the everyday sexism that women experience. And in particular, walking down the street and being catcalled. My daughter, 17 years old, will roll down the window and yell at a group of men who are ogling at a woman walking by. And I'm getting older, and I'm doing the same thing. I want to know, what do you all do? I want to know, because I'm looking at these men like, will someone say something? Can someone stand up to them and say, stop that? And I'm starting to do that myself, but I want to know, what are you saying to the everyday sexism that we experience as women walking down the street?
In my groups, what we do is we do role playing, and so we do that, and we do it to them, and then we talk about how you experienced that, how did that feel, and then we process that, and then hopefully they get the idea that if you're feeling this way, maybe you're making somebody feel that way, and do you want them to feel that way? So it's putting the onus on them, and also my groups are sometimes 6 to 10 kids, so hopefully those 6 to 10 kids are taking their message. I'm asking them to talk to one of their friends. If you can get one, you know what I'm saying? If you can carry this message that we're trying to do, or the message that we're trying to receive in this room, if you can carry that out to one person, you know what I'm saying, then we can make a change. So hopefully, it's making a difference. And I just tell a quick story about a kid who, when I first met him, he had 3 cell phones, 14 girlfriends on 3 different phones. I don't know how he did it. And on the 23rd week, he came in with 1 cell phone, and he was like, I can't do it no more, you know what I'm saying? And because my thing was like, just tell him, like, if you're going to be real about it, just be like, yo, I want to have sex with you, and you want to have sex with me, why are you playing this game with him? Why are you being dishonest about it? And so he came in with the 1 cell phone and was like, all right, I'm not having a girlfriend. So hopefully the message is getting through, you know what I'm saying? So hopefully we can continue to work with him.
I think, so there are 2 things that come to mind immediately. One is, I don't actually see it that often when I walk down the street with women. I'm not a large man. I am a black man. When I walk down the street with somebody, like, it's just less likely to happen, I find. And like, that's, so like for me, like that's been like my racialized experience of that. And when it does happen, so the first thing that I do in my way, right, is to like listen. And be like, oh, like that just happened, right? Like, I think one of the things that we do really well is that collusion piece that Juan was talking about. Minimize it, deny it, ignore it, pretend it didn't happen. So, you know, so step one for me is like, oh, like, wow, like, right. And then listen for some of that expectation. So, like, I can go and speak and, like, try to, you know, get in there and be like, yo, man, that's messed up. And, like, have that conversation. Or try, right? Like, I can, so I've done that. And I find that that is not always what's being asked of me, right? Like, sometimes what's being asked of me is like, yo, you see what your man just did? And, like, that's, and yes, right? Like, and that's what's being asked of me. And that's the expectation that's been put on me. Because I think one of the things that can trip us up when we talk about this good guy, bad guy thing is that I can get put in this, like, Superman savior role and be like, all right, now I need to go talk to all the dudes and tell them how they all need to be.
Yeah.
And I find that that doesn't work so well.
Hmm.
So I try to, like, just balance that out. Balance, like, my own stuff around, like, all right, so what's my role? How do I speak? What do I need to say? You know, how do I hear and listen and validate and recognize and acknowledge this experience that this woman just had? And then move from there.
Cool. Does anybody else want to take on that question?
If I could, just real quickly. And that's very tough, sis. And I think about maybe one of the first call-ins I went to, and I heard Tony Porter talk about, I think it was your daughter and her experience on the train. And, you know, all the different people that stepped to you in different levels of it. But some of my conversation with these young men, and that comes up a lot, but, you know, you got to kind of really understand that these guys, a lot of them do that because that's part of them defining themselves and their manhood and their levels of defining themselves in terms of this scale of masculinity. So what I really try to do is kind of talk to them around respect and who they respect and why. And a lot of times it's the reason why it continues to happen is because a lot of these young men are one picking these things up from adults and adult men in their lives. So part of it for me, and I think for the many of the men on this panel, is we have to kind of demonstrate a different and alternative way of, you know, interacting with women that we're connected to or we're not connected to. And it goes to, in terms of how we view women, attitudes and belief systems. You know, we believe that that person is a piece of property, all of these things. So it makes it easier for us to kind of like view them in that way and treat them in that way. So a lot of it is really around having conversations around who they respect and really trying to shifting the attitudes and beliefs, and hopefully that behavior will change. But so it's a multi-level and multi-pronged approach to really dealing with that. But really having conversations with them around, you know, why is it that they're doing that? And most of the times it's going to be connected to, I have to do that because of the other guys I'm with. I have to kind of show and prove to them I got to kind of get inside that box a little bit. So it's a long-term conversation, but it really is, I think, is rooted into those attitudes and belief systems that men and young boys are being socialized to have.
I think the answer for me to that is that it's a very complex answer, because for us as men, with the best of intentions, we may want to do what's right, and we end up doing things wrong. And part of it is that education, kind of bringing it back to men who you are connected to and kind of having that conversation about what it is to change our own sexism in our community and kind of speak to that. It also means having the ability to check yourself before you check somebody else. Because I may not say something to her or catcall her, but I see her coming down the block and I've already done everything I want to do with her in my mind. That's a problem too. So we got to address those things, and when we're doing the work, and we got to do that honestly. But the education piece is key, because we need to make these conversations kind of unique and make them safe for us as men to have with one another. Because that box can be very, you know, entrapping to men. And the one thing that I have to say about the box as we know it is that as men, we've also learned how to manipulate it, because to me it's a little outdated. As men, we've learned how to navigate in and out of that box very safely, but it's because we have the power to say where and when we belong in it. So we do have the power to have that ability to make some change. Whether or not it's accepted by other men, that's the question. And that's where we need to start, making it safe for us to have this conversation amongst each other as men, and really addressing that issue. Why do I need to do that? Is it acceptable for me to do that to a woman and ask and demand respect for the woman in my life, the women in my life? Because if you look at it, then we look at masculinity, I'm not living up to that box either because I'm a hypocrite, right? So, you know, I think the conversation needs to be had in a very serious way, and say that it's complex. Not be afraid to struggle with it. I remember early on, you know, I found myself walking down a block with Ted, and this was when I was first starting, and I wasn't saying nothing, but he whispered in my ear, "Hey, your eyes are wandering." And you know, you need somebody to check you that way, but do it in a way where it's not unsafe to say, "I'm struggling with this, can you help me? What did I do wrong? Explain to me what I did wrong. And how would you do it?" We can't be afraid to have the conversation with each other.
All right, cool. In the best interest of time, I want to try and get to a few more questions before we have to wrap up. Okay, I see you with the microphone. Okay.
Thank you. So somebody said yesterday that we have to be 5 years ahead of whatever we're bringing to the table, right? So I want to know what kind of work you've done on yourselves before you can go in and start talking to guys. What kind of work have you done for reflection to start challenging the stuff? Because we all were socialized, and we have to start unsocializing and deconstructing. So what have you done to lead that within yourself?
Okay, how about we have one person answer that question so we can get to another question?
Something I've learned how to do is basically, I can't speak to the issue of sexism if I can't understand oppression as a whole. And as a man of color, I understand oppression very well. So that means that I can't really go into my own oppression and deal with it and try to educate others around it without really kind of practicing what it means to, you know, cut down all oppressions on the same level, because they all have the same ingredients to it. They may look different, but they all have the same ingredients, and that we really need to kind of combat each one as if it were one. Because at the end of the day, me challenging my sexism can mean me challenging other things in my life that can benefit my community, can benefit my kids, can benefit everyone. Because if I look at oppression as one singular thing that we need to fight against, then social change means fighting oppression on all levels. You know, one thing a mentor of mine said to me once was that in any revolution, you need change from top to bottom, but that first begins with how you treat each other as individuals. And that means that women need to be side by side with us, not behind us or in front of us, which means that we also have to listen to women and hear from them how they experience us in this world in order to learn how to live amongst them.
All right, cool. Anybody have any other questions?
Yeah, you just mentioned there's a phrase that you just used a minute ago. You said, what we do in our minds. And I guess that's someplace I haven't gone yet with the groups that I meet with men of varying ages. And I guess I sometimes go there one-on-one with men. But I guess anybody, would you talk... have a strategy for talking to a group of men about, you know, what are the limits? How do you talk about that? What's going on in your head, as opposed to just the behavioral aspects of what you're exhibiting on the outside?
Real quickly, because I'm not trying to do self promotion, but what I'm doing right now, I have this men's roundtable for men who are working with men. Right, and this is the opportunity for us to kind of say, what does it look like to hold each other accountable? And you know, part of my work with batterers, and you know, and again, you're not reaching a whole lot of men in batterers groups. So you know, it's really the work outside of this field where you got to meet men. But the reality part of it is creating that safe space to have some real conversations and challenging conversations, and not being afraid to be critiqued. So that's part of it. But then, really. Creating community, and that's the most important piece, because if somebody goes through a batterers group 26, 52 weeks, and they go back out into the rest of the world, I started doing this work with youth, And I'd had them for like maybe 9 or 12 weeks. It was good, but they kept coming back because the rest of the world is, you know, pushing, you know, sexist ideas and values and et cetera. So it's really creating community where you can have safe conversations. And I encourage people here who are doing work that we need to kind of create community amongst ourselves to push us to the next levels. Because, and part of your question is, the work is ongoing. The transformation for me is ongoing. I think we learn the most out of every group that we facilitate or workshops we do than the people that were in the workshops to learn from us. We're learning the most. So it's really, it's an ongoing process and struggle, but creating safe spaces to have conversations and creating that community as much as possible.
We have time for one more question, I believe, right? One more question. I think this young woman right here had her hand up. I saw her raising her hand a few minutes ago.
Hi. So I have a question that is both personal and I think addresses the larger question about why we're here. A few years ago, I was co-facilitating high school boys groups and groups with fraternity men around all of these issues of masculinity and homophobia and sexism. And for me, this work is the work of my heart. I loved it. It was very fulfilling. And as I've moved a little bit in my life, I've been trying to think about what my role as a woman might be in doing this work around masculinity with men. And I think I can't tell if what I've come up with is a justification for the fact that I should be doing this work, which is that it's important to have a woman in the room both to check the situation and to create, to have, when the group sees a team of co-facilitators, a man and a woman doing it together, they can see a healthy model of men and women working together. And also, if they see that I'm not judging them and I allow them to say what they need to say, then they can maybe ask me some questions as a trusted woman who's not going to jump down their throat. So my question is, as men and women working together in this movement and as we move forward and think about primary prevention, it's kind of a funny question, but what is a woman's role in doing this work with men? Is this a justification that I've come up with, or is it actually effective?
Well, I think that doing the work, especially as allies, is key, especially when you're doing it with young people, because not only are you modeling for them that men and women can work together without one having authority over the other, or any feelings come up for them is positive. I think sometimes as men, we do need women around, even if they're not present there, for you to catch up with a woman after you do a group or anything and kind of say, this is what I did today, what do you think? For them to tell us, well, I think you need to do it this way next time. Because as men, we're very good at shaping women's realities and very little on shaping our own reality. So it's key to always have that input from a woman. So I think a woman's role is key to always be there, especially when we're trying to work this out ourselves as men. And as men, I think we need to make that space that we have very, you know, comforting, not only for ourselves, but for that woman and those people, those men or young men in the room. And sometimes not, you know, we take things so serious, but sometimes we need to, especially as men doing the work with other men, kind of make it fun. You know, Ted and Tony made me enjoy this work because it was sometimes about telling on ourselves. And for all those men out there who are hearing me, you know, sometimes telling on ourselves could be a pretty funny story. Some of the things that we do with one another. You know, and the ability to do that and then have a conversation behind that, especially as men doing the work with one another. I can't tell you how much I value that and what Ted and Tony have provided for me. Just real quick, Byron, mm-hmm. I'm going to put him on blast because he made me feel so bad a couple of weeks back when he called me to talk about the conference. Tony's talking to me, and he hears my dog in the background. And he asked me, hey, Juan, what kind of dog you got? And I said, a Pompoo. And he said, what? He said, man, what did you say? I said, a Pompoo. He said, man, I thought you were going to tell me a rock. What kind of man has a Pompoo? So I kind of sat with that as he's laughing at me, right?
as he's laughing at me, I sat with that, and I was like, well, what kind of dog do you have? He goes, well, you know, because of my daughter, I got to keep. So.
Wow.
So it's very easy. What I'm trying to say is it's very easy for us to sometimes feel like work needs to be done in a clear and direct way, and that we never have complications show up for us. But the key to that is when those complications show up, or when those questions show up, that we're able to work through it together, especially as men and women doing the work together, or men and men doing the work together. That's key.
Yeah. Well, I think, Quentin, you gotta wrap it up. I'm sorry, brother. Well, I think that's a really great way to end this panel discussion, right? It's 4:15. Our time is up. Please give these men a round of applause for the work that they do, for their courage, for their dedication.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.